Okay, so today is Tuesday, September 3rd. We're going to be working on protein synthesis review. All right, so let's talk about some key terms we talked about last class period. First off, transcribe means we're taking a strand of DNA and rewriting it into what?
RNA.
And where inside the cell does this take place? Nucleus, right. So the reason we're doing this is because the DNA shouldn't be taken out of the nucleus. In fact, we don't want to move it through a nuclear pore, but we can take an mRNA strand or messenger RNA strand out through a nuclear pore. Messenger RNA or mRNA is what we're making through transcription, and it carries codes grouped in how many nucleotides?
Three.
And that code is called a what?
Codon.
Good. So we've got TAC, that's a codon. It translates into start. And so the next step, translation, actually takes us to the ribosomes in the cytoplasm. They may be found free, or they may be found attached to what other organelle?
The rough
endoplasmic reticulum. So we're heading to ribosomes, whether they're free-floating or attached to a rough ER, and that's where we perform translation. And that's the second set of steps here, taking our mRNA strand, taking those codons, and translating them using that codon chart. Did want to mention, you do not have to memorize the codon chart on page 30. That will be provided for you on test day, so do not spend your time memorizing that codon chart. All right, so in order to make sure you've done this correctly, I will always build in a start and a stop codon. That tells our tRNA molecule, the one that's transferring those amino acids, technically where to start and where to stop making the protein. So AUG should code for start. CCA, your next one, should code for proline. Lysine is your next one, alanine, and then finally a stop codon. Those amino acids are actually held together by a special kind of bond. Do you remember from last week what bond holds together amino acids? Peptide. Good. So these, in fact, are peptide bonds. They're specialized covalent bonds that hold together those proteins. Now, proteins are built from building blocks known as what? Amino acids. Good. So what we've just done, is this an anabolic reaction or a catabolic reaction?
Anabolic.
Anabolic, right. What does anabolic mean?
Building.
Yeah, that's exactly what we did. We just built a protein, not a very fancy one, but we've got a protein nonetheless. How'd you do with this one here? Do you need another one to practice on?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Let me give you one more. Okay, keep in mind that transcription is taking DNA, rewriting it into RNA, and that translation, the second step, takes that mRNA strand and rewrites it into amino acids.
here's the answers when you're ready to check.
Did you do okay?
Mm-hmm.
Any questions? Let me just repeat one more time, because on the test, these questions are separate. There will be a question that says to transcribe the DNA, and at that point, you want to rewrite your DNA into an mRNA strand. And the key to remember here is replacing your thymines or T's with what? With U's. That's one question by itself. The second question later on in the test will be to translate, and at that point we'll give you something like, you know, a DNA or an RNA strand. You will have to work through to the point that you get your amino acids. There will be a codon chart on there for you. So you want to make sure to remember, okay, codon chart, I've got to make these amino acids. There are no T's in the mRNA strand, so if you're using something like ATG, you know, as your mRNA strand, obviously that's not going to work for your codon chart. Just make sure you go back and translate properly. So that'll help you kind of, it'll kind of kickstart you into remembering, oh, I've got to do the new thing here. By contrast, we did on Thursday something called DNA replication. Mm-hmm. DNA replication is totally different from this. That involves taking a DNA strand and just copying it. So it is the simplest process that we can do. All we do there is just take our A's and T's and pair them together, our C's and G's. So be sure to look out for those keywords. Replicate means to copy. That's A's and T's, C's and G's. Okay, replicate means to copy that A's and T's, C's and G's. Okay, by contrast, transcription rewrites DNA into what?
RNA.
Yes.
Messenger RNA.
You're right. Messenger RNA. Good.
That's where I got confused on the quiz. The difference, knowing the difference to do which one to do. I know how to do it, but I didn't know if I was translating or copying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because copying is different than translating.
Right.
You're right. Okay, so transcription takes your DNA, rewrites it into mRNA. And what is translation? Amino acids. Yeah, take your mRNA and rewrite it into amino acids. Okay, translation takes your mRNA, rewrites it into amino acids. Okay, so just to repeat, look out for replicate, transcribe, and translate. Use those three keywords to help you know what to do. Replicate just simply means to copy. You pair A's and T's, C's and G's together. Transcribe takes your DNA, rewrites it into mRNA. That is the clue to replace your thymines with what?
Uracil.
Good. And then the final process there under protein synthesis is translation. That now takes our RNA strand and rewrites it into amino acids. So I just want to kind of put those three words out there and make sure you review them at home for that test. All right. So I know some of you didn't hear my opening spiel today, so I wanted to make sure I mentioned that test number one is actually going to be moved to Tuesday. That way we avoid whatever is going on Thursday with this hurricane. I'm wondering if the school's going to be canceled, so just in case it is, we're going to have the test on Tuesday. I hope that works out for your schedules. I'm going to be smiling about that, like, yeah, that's going to give you another week right to study, so I hope that's a good thing for you. If we do have class on Thursday, we'll just go ahead and cover the next bit of material on tissues, but, you know, I'm guessing we're probably not. We're just going to have to wait and see what the calls are around here. All right. So that should wrap up this stuff on protein synthesis that we did on Thursday. Is there anything that I can help review or go back over on those topics? do you feel about this material, replication and protein synthesis? Do you feel pretty good? A little sketchy? Just something you need to review a little bit? Okay.
Clarify. The replication's occurring inside the nucleus, right?
That's right.
So that's DNA to DNA.
That's right.
And then when you do the transcription to mRNA, that's still inside the nucleus.
That's right.
And then it goes outside the nucleus through the pores, the ribosomes to translate.
That's exactly right. Good.
I don't know why my brain thinks that's so hard.
But you got it right. You got it down
pat.
You can just remember that for a Tuesday, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so today's topic is shifting gears a little bit. It's membrane transport. So I'd like to take you over to page 35. Actually, a good review for us to go over the plasma membrane one more time. We did talk about the plasma membrane structure in class last Thursday, but I want to repeat that stuff today. It is relevant to understanding membrane transport. What you're looking at is a typical cell membrane or plasma membrane. Pretty much every cell in your body has one of these membranes covering it on the outside, creating a boundary between your cell and the outside world. So you'll notice there are two layers here. Two layers of what? Two layers of phospholipids. Good. Do you recall the structure of a typical phospholipid? Heads and tails. Good. What do those heads like?
Water.
And the tails, how do they behave? They don't like water, yes. So there's actually a layer of heads pointed outward toward your cell's fluids, or the interstitial fluids, rather. And the tails, because they don't like water, are actually hiding on the inside. The other layer of heads is actually pointing to the interior of your cell. So there's, in fact, two layers of phospholipids here, you know, creating a boundary around your cell. Now, there's more going on than just those phospholipids. We have proteins that go all the way through the phospholipid bilayer. They are called what?
Integral.
Good. And some proteins are just found on one side or the other. They're called peripheral proteins. And this sticky outer covering of the cell has a special name. It's called
glycocalyx.
Good. So there's carbohydrate chains. There's glycolipid chains. Glyco is a prefix. Means what?
Sugar.
Means sugar. Right. So there's sugar fat chains. There are sugar protein chains, and there's carbs out here. So that sticky outer surface is what allows for one cell to stay anchored and stuck to another cell. So kind of interesting the way that outer surface doesn't look like the way the inner surface looks for that cell. I think I made the joke last class period that the cell's membrane looks like a sandwich. Just wanted to repeat that one more time. These heads on the outer surface are like a layer of bread. These tails on the inside are kind of like, you know, the meat inside your sandwich, and then your other layer of bread makes the innermost layer of heads. There are cholesterol molecules shoved through. There are integral proteins that are like taking a toothpick and just shoving them all the way through your membrane layer. So there's a lot going on here, but what I'm going to focus on right now is the pickiness of those phospholipid tails. What do they dislike? They dislike water. So that's going to kind of influence our conversation today. The fact that this membrane is semi-permeable or selectively permeable influences how we can move things across the bilayer. And the fact that this membrane doesn't like water is going to drive these movements of molecules and ions across the membrane.
When it doesn't like water, does it mean
it's
polar?
If you don't like water, you are non-polar. Yeah, if you like water, you're polar. In order to have a conversation today, I'd like to mention a couple of terms here. They are on the top of 35, solutes and solvent. Do you like sweet tea or maybe coffee? Maybe one or the other?
Okay, so if you make sweet tea or maybe you sweeten your coffee, you may pour some sugar substance into your drink and then you mix it up. The sugar that you're pouring in is actually what we call a solute. The tea or coffee that you're putting that sugar into is called our solvent. So what happens to your sugar when you pour it in, say, hot tea or hot coffee? It dissolves. So now you say, well, my sugar mixed with the tea or the coffee, and I now have a solution. So there's a couple of things we can learn from this. One, the solute is typically the item in a smaller amount. It is also the part of your solution that's being dissolved. Put the sugar in your coffee or your tea. The sugar is certainly a smaller amount. It becomes dissolved by that solution. If you're making sweetened drinks, the solvent is your greater amount. Tiffany, did you have a question?
I was getting confused, but the sugar is the solvent.
Solute.
Solute.
That's right.
Because the lesser amount is being added.
That's right.
And the greater amount is going to dissolve or consume.
That's right.
Okay.
Okay, so when you make coffee or tea, you may use, say, a cup of sugar, but you may have a gallon of liquid. The smaller amount, the solute's being dissolved by that gallon of tea. In our bodies, we have about 5 liters of blood. We have a small amount of solutes dissolved in our bloodstream. So we could say in our bloodstream, you know, the blood fluids itself are actually behaving as our solvent. Okay. And I got another example there for you on your worksheet. Carbon dioxide actually is a small part of your bloodstream. It becomes dissolved by your bloodstream. So is carbon dioxide your solute or your solvent?
Solute.
Solute is right. And the blood, of course, the fluid in your blood is the solvent. That's it. Good. So today I'm going to talk about solute concentration. And what that means is how much solute did I put into a solvent and do dissolving? If, let's just use some numbers here. If I like really unsweet tea, I may put a teaspoon of sugar in my gallon of tea. That's not very sweet at all. That's a low solute concentration. That's like maybe, let's just say it's 1% solute concentration. Let's say that your buddy likes really sickeningly sweet iced tea, and this person puts in 2 cups of sugar. So compare your teaspoon that you put in to their 2 cups of sugar. Their solute concentration is much higher than yours. So we're going to say their solute concentration is like 10%. So do you see where I'm going here? The more solute you add to a solvent, the greater the concentration of the solute. So in our bodies, our fluids are around 2 to 3% solute concentration. That means we're not really that salty. You know, we can be salty, right? But we're not really that salty. So we don't have a whole lot of dissolved items in our bloodstream, but we have enough to be able to function. So we're going to talk about that solute concentration, how much dissolved substance you have in your solvent. Do you feel okay about these words? Okay. We're going to talk next about passive and active transport. And what I've left for you on the bottom of page 35 is just a summary. There's some stuff written there already. You've got passive transport includes diffusion, osmosis, facilitated diffusion, and then you've got over here active transport includes solute pumping, endocytosis, and exocytosis. In fact, this is the summary that you can jot down on the bottom of the page. Okay, so let's talk through passive transport. The word passive means no ATP is required by your cell to move substances across the plasma membrane. In other words, these items can freely flow from high to low concentration across your membrane, and that may be into your cell, that may be out of your cell. But the catch here is that there's no energy required for these molecules to move into or out of your cell. The goal is to reach equilibrium, meaning the solute concentration is the same on either side of your plasma membrane. So if there's more sodiums on one side, less sodiums on the other side, the tendency is for those ions to move from high to low concentration until they're evenly spread out. So, you know, it's just a passive process, meaning there's no energy required for your cell to manage this process. Sometimes we call diffusion simple diffusion. I just wanted to make that note. Diffusion is sometimes called simple diffusion. And of course, osmosis is the movement of water. We'll talk about that in a moment, and facilitated diffusion. Active transport means that there is ATP required. And so let's talk about this thing called a concentration gradient for a moment. I don't have a whole lot of space over here on this side, but I'm going to draw these X's to represent molecules. Okay, and if I have just a few molecules over here, where would you say my high concentration of molecules are located? At the top. So this is going to be my high concentration. Let's say this is a cell membrane sitting right there. Their natural tendency is going to be to move to that area of low concentration. So when we move from high to low, is that passive or active transport?
Passive.
Passive, yeah. So the cell just says, hey, do what you want. Come and go whenever. I'm okay with it. No ATP is required. Where this becomes an issue for the cell is if we want to take these three molecules or whatever they are, and we want to move them outside where there's already a huge collection of them. In order to move from low to high concentration, what does this cell have to do? It has to spend energy. So to move from low to high concentration, we say this is a type of active transport. And anytime you do this against the gradient thing, you're going to have to use ATP to pump those molecules. So what we're looking at here are gradients. High concentration, low concentration. This creates an unequal environment. And if there's anything your body hates, it is to be not at equilibrium, right? That whole homeostasis thing, we want to be at equilibrium. So the whole goal here is to maintain equilibrium. Passive transport's easy, no ATP required. But if you're going to create a disturbance and go against the normal flow, you're going to have to go active. You're going to have to pump. Probably the easiest example I can give for you to understand this is writing down a slide. It is so easy to sit at the top of a slide, kind of like high concentration, and slide to the bottom. That's no problem. You can do that all day, every day. There's no effort for that. Where the effort comes is to go the other way, right? Get on the bottom of the slide and decide that you're going to climb back up to the top for another ride down. You're working against the normal flow of things, so that's when we have to use active transport. So just something to think about when we're going through this, that active requires energy. That's what the word means. Passive means no energy is required here. So we're going to talk about two types of passive transport, diffusion or simple diffusion and facilitated diffusion. And we're also going to talk about osmosis as well. So let me take you on over to page 36. So like I mentioned, diffusion is sometimes called simple diffusion. It is the easiest one of our membrane transport processes to understand. What would you describe as happening in this picture?
They're spreading out equally.
So let's watch again. Where's the high concentration? Yeah, and there, those molecules are spreading away from each other toward an area of lower concentration. They're bouncing off of each other. They will eventually find a resting place where there's a little bit of bounce, but their goal is to be evenly spread from one another. So there is random kinetic energy built into those molecules that allows for them to bounce off of each other and eventually spread them to an area of equilibrium. So, you know, if you've ever driven by a farm, you've probably noticed that most farmers don't plant all 1,000 of their seeds in a hole right there, right? They take those seeds and spread them out at equilibrium. Same concept for our body. These molecules, whether they're gases, whether they're sodium ions or potassium ions, their goal is to be evenly distributed, called equilibrium here. So you know the concept. If anybody's ever dined with you and had gas at the table, you know to hold your breath, right? Because that smell's coming for you. You already understand that molecules will diffuse from an area of high concentration to an area of low concentration until it eventually reaches an equilibrium in the air. So we already understand that diffusion means molecules spread out until they reach an even distribution. Okay, so on your worksheet there, you've got solutes moving from high to low concentration. Our goal is equilibrium. Is any ATP required for this process? Nope, the cell does nothing. The cell is completely not involved in this process. Some examples of diffusible substances. This is number 4, about halfway down page 36. Okay, some examples of diffusible substances include carbon dioxide and oxygen. Carbon dioxide and oxygen. You may also want to include things like small ions. Carbon dioxide, oxygen, small ions can also diffuse. So you get to Bio 211 and you talk about gases like carbon dioxide and oxygen traveling through your bloodstream. They will diffuse out into your cells and tissues just like these gases move among other molecules. So there is no energy required in order for these molecules to diffuse into the cells and tissues of your body. Okay, so there is something to note about how molecules move by simple diffusion. The fact that molecules are small means that they can squeeze through your phospholipid bilayer. Why is it important for molecules to be small enough to squeeze through? What if they were big? They couldn't go through, they wouldn't fit. And if they were large molecules, what would happen to the integrity of your membrane? Yeah, you'd have a hole burst through it, right? So if these were huge molecules trying to fit through your plasma membrane, they could rip holes in it. And then what happens to your cell?
Ruptures,
yes. Yeah, so that membrane is meant to be a boundary around the cell. And if you poke holes in it to the point that it ruptures, it no longer can serve a function of being a protective entity around your cell. So that is something key about these small ions and carbon dioxide and oxygen. They are tiny enough to fit through your phospholipid bilayer. Let me take you back to look at this plasma membrane for just a moment as well. Something else about these items that move through your cell membrane, they tend to be lipid-based. Well, what about that phospholipid set of tails? How do they feel about water? Don't like water. They are hydrophobic. They are nonpolar. But they do like fatty molecules. So anything that's fat-based, these tails say, oh, you look just like me. Come on through. That's no problem. So fat-based molecules, you know, whatever they are, steroids, hormones that are fat-based, you know, triglycerides, these phospholipid tails, which are normally saying, oh, wait, whoa, you know, wait, you can't come through, they say to these fats, come on through. So if you're a tiny, tiny molecule, or if you're a fat-based molecule, then the cell membrane says, hey, come on through, you know, we don't even have to have a conversation. You just pass right through those phospholipid bilayers. All right, so just want to make the note about those two things. All right, so down near the bottom of your page, I did want to mention that temperature influences the rate of diffusion in your body. It says cooler temperatures slow diffusion. What do warmer temperatures do? Speed it up. If you have a fever, you may breathe faster, and one of the reasons for that is to get more oxygen in. The fever makes your body diffuse those gases more quickly. Viscosity is another influencer over diffusion rates. Viscosity means how thick your fluids are. And if you're dehydrated, your blood's pretty thick. So if you're properly hydrated or even overhydrated, your blood may be thinner. So the viscosity or the thickness of your blood also influences the rates of diffusion. So it says there, the more fluid the environment, the faster the diffusion rates will occur. Otherwise, the thicker the fluid, the slower the diffusion rates occur. So that blink there is slower. Thicker fluids, so if you're dehydrated, your diffusion rates will occur more slowly. Okay, so what do you know about diffusion to summarize at the very bottom of our page? Good. Our goal is equilibrium. That's one thing to note. No energy is required. That's another one to note. Good. Molecules here travel from high to low concentration. Okay, so if you need those three again, goal is equilibrium. No ATP or energy is required. And molecules travel from high to low concentration. What is the catch about the size of those molecules? They must be what? They must be small. Can they be water-based? Cannot be water-based, but they can be fat. Yeah, they can be fat-based. So if you're a fatty molecule or if you're a tiny, tiny molecule, you can diffuse without any trouble with that cell membrane. Okay, so we sometimes call diffusion simple diffusion. Let's now talk about osmosis. Let's start with this picture here. We just talked about what can diffuse easily. We know that small items can diffuse easily. We know that fatty-based molecules can diffuse easily. Your cell membrane is picky. In fact, we call it semi-permeable or selectively permeable because it picks what can come through based on its structure. Some molecules cannot travel through. So let's say that we have a cell with a bunch of sugar sitting on one side. We can exclude that sugar from traveling across the cell membrane. So a large amount of sugar may build up on one side of that membrane, and a smaller amount may be on the other side of the membrane. This actually looks like it's pretty equal because we're actually moving those molecules to create equilibrium. But before we do that, you know, we may have a large amount of molecules sitting on one side versus the other side. The issue here is that we can't sometimes move the molecules to create equilibrium. Sometimes we have to move the water to create the equilibrium. So, what is it about the water molecules and these phospholipid tails? Don't like them. Yep, so those phospholipid tails say, hey, can't move water here. So we have to find another way to move water to create equilibrium, and that is by using a protein channel, an integral protein, called an aquaporin. So this green thing here, this is an aquaporin, literally a water channel that allows water to move across your cell membrane. So why move water? What are we trying to do to the solute concentration on either side of your cell membrane? Make equilibrium. Exactly, good. So let me just repeat what's happening here. The reason that water is moving is because you may have an uneven distribution of, say, glucose molecules on either side of your membrane. Maybe you can't move the glucose, but you can move the water molecules and create equilibrium in terms of our solute concentration. So water always, always, always moves toward the higher solute concentration. An easy way to remember this is water follows salt. Okay, water always follows to the higher solute concentration. water always follows to the higher solute concentration, we say that water follows salt. Salt could be sugar, salt could be salt, whatever the concentration gradient is there, we always go toward the higher solute or salt concentration. These aquaporins are kind of cool. They only discovered them around the year 2000, so we haven't known about them all that long. And it was a Nobel Prize for somebody that figured out how those aquaporins channeled water through our cells. So if you don't want water coming through, then don't have aquaporins, because those are just simply water channels that bypass those phospholipids. In fact, why do you have to have an aquaporin? Yeah, the phospholipids will not let the water through, so you have to go another route, and this water channel here, this aquaporin, allows water to come through. So water always travels to the highest salt or solute concentration. So this animation's actually not quite correct. They're showing you with water molecules traveling across the membrane, but in fact, those water molecules, they look like Mickey Mouse ears, those things there. They should be traveling through aquaporins, and they did not draw them on this animation. But nonetheless, they can travel freely through aquaporins and equalize salt or solute concentration. Okay, so I'm going to let this run in the background while we come over here and talk about three types of osmosis, or three conditions for osmosis. So let's talk about hypotonic, isotonic, and hypertonic. The first thing I want to do is mention that osmosis is water movement to reach a solute equilibrium. So when we talk about this, we have to keep in mind that water's not just moving because it feels like it. Water's being drawn to an area that has a higher what?
Concentration.
Good. This word here, hypotonic, what does hypo mean as a prefix?
Below.
Good. And tonic, we can say, means concentration. So this is an area of lower or below concentration. So in order to understand this, let's take a cell from our bloodstream, a red blood cell. Let's extract it out and plop it into a solution. When you plop a red blood cell into a concentration that's less than its own concentration, then we're going to see some movement of water to reach equilibrium. Let's say that our cell has 3% solute concentration. What does that mean about the salts that are in there? It's low. It's a fairly low number. What does 0% tell you about the surrounding solution? There's no salt in the surrounding solution. Well, we know that water likes to move to areas of higher salt concentration, and the whole goal is to reach equilibrium for that salt concentration. So what's going to happen to the water in this beaker? It's going to move into the cell. Why is that?
Water follows
salt. And at 3% salt concentration, there's more salt in our cell than in solution. So what happens to the shape of your cell?
It swells.
It swells, it bloats, it can even rupture or lysis if it stays in this solution. So we say the water enters the cell. That cell can bloat. Left here long enough, it will eventually rupture or lyse. So why did water enter that cell? Water follows salt, and the saltier concentration is inside that cell. Okay, so about halfway down your page, you've got the hypotonic solution. Hypo means below. Water follows salt. That's one reason water enters the cell. And the second reason is to reach equilibrium. The goal of having the water move in is to reach equilibrium. Water follows salt. And another reason water enters is because our goal is to reach equilibrium. So let me talk to you a little bit about hypotonic solutions. What you drink is hypotonic. Pretty much any drink on the market is hypotonic. You have a thirst mechanism that works by negative feedback that will cut you off and say, you know, I'm probably feeling pretty sloshy, full of fluids, and I'll probably need to stop drinking now. So most of us don't go buy a 2-liter bottle and say, all right, this is lunch, right? You know, we normally know how much we can drink and when our thirst mechanism says you're full of fluids. So the catch is that the thirst mechanism keeps you from getting to the point of being lysed or having those cells rupture. If you're dehydrated, the whole goal of you drinking is to bloat your cells. So whether it's tap water, whether it's apple juice, soft drinks, tea, even alcohol, whatever you drink is going to be hypotonic in nature. And you prevent yourself from getting to the point of lysing because of your thirst mechanism. You know, there have been hazing incidents over the years where they take kids and they say, hey, you want to join our group, whether it's a fraternity or whatever, drink this, you know, liter of alcohol. Well, unfortunately, not only do they get alcohol poisoning, but that is hypotonic in nature, and they can make their cells rupture if they do that. These fraternities decided, hey, you know, maybe alcohol is too dangerous. Let's use something that they thought was harmless. They thought milk was harmless. And they would say, hey, drink this gallon of milk or drink this gallon of water. Well, if you sit and drink an entire gallon of anything, what's going to happen to your cells? They bloat, they rupture, okay? So if you drink a gallon in 30 minutes or an hour, you don't give your kidneys time to flush out all the excess fluid, and your cells just bloat. And so that's called hypotonic hydration. It's water intoxication. It's basically being drunk off of water. It can make your brain swell. It can kill you. So that's why if somebody's getting a hypotonic drip in the hospital, we want to make sure they're doing what? What comes in must go out. Yeah, they got to pee, right? So if you're putting on a hypotonic drip and they're not peeing off the fluids, they got to be going somewhere, and that's into their cells. So their brain can swell, their brain can actually become so swollen that it shuts down in the foramen magnum and shuts off brain function. So that's why we want to say, okay, you put a liter of fluid in, you should be getting somewhere near that coming back out. So hypotonic fluids can make you bloat. Left too long, they can cause us to rupture.
So hypotonic is too much fluid?
It can be too much fluid for your cells. Normally we listen to our bodies and we stop drinking before we get to the point of lysing. But if you haven't had anything to drink for a day or two, then you're going to want to bloat your cells, and you drink until you firm their cells back up. Do you have questions on hypotonic solutions? This is where your cells want to be. They want to be in a concentration that's the same as their own concentration. So iso here means same. If our cell has a 3% solute concentration, what should our solution be?
3%.
Yeah, should be 3%. This is every cell's happy place. Okay, so when you're in equilibrium, you're not going to have water necessarily flooding out. You're not going to have it moving in. It's just going to be no net gain of water by your cell, no net loss of water by your cell. So about the only drink on the market that's somewhat isotonic to ourselves is something like Gatorade or Pedialyte because of the amount of electrolytes in those fluids. But that is the only thing that comes close to being isotonic to ourselves.
So no matter how much Gatorade or Pedialyte you drink, it'll never ever go over.
You can?
Well, I mean, not like a gallon, but I mean like a continent. It'll never.
If you, if like right now, let's say I'm properly hydrated, if I drink Gatorade or Pedialyte, maybe a cup or two of it, then I'll probably stay in equilibrium with the Gatorade or Pedialyte, assuming that it's isotonic. But if I drink a gallon of it right now, I'm going to put too much fluid in and I'm going to cause a hypotonic situation. But if you're dehydrated, like heck, if somebody's had diarrhea and vomiting and they have no fluids and their skin is all like tinted up, then they may be able to drink more before they get to the point of reaching equilibrium. So I wouldn't necessarily say that Gatorade or Pedialyte is harmless at any amount. I would say that your thirst mechanism, your brain's going to say, I don't really feel like drinking anymore. That's when you know you've reached proper equilibrium, and you'll shut off your drinking mechanism. The other scenario, or last scenario, is hypertonic fluids, and these are more concentrated than our cells. What does that prefix hyper tell us? Above, good, above or higher. And this time, let's take out a blood cell, let's plop it in a solution. So give me a number for your solution this time. 6%. Does that work? Because it is higher than your cell. So we may not be able to move whatever's in the solution. It may be a lot of salt, it may be a lot of sugar, whatever it is, we can't move it. But the water can move through those aquaporins. And the water's always going to move to where there's more salt or solute concentration. What happens to your cell in this kind of solution?
It's going to shrivel up.
Shrivel up or shrink up, right. So water's going to leave that cell.
You said what happens with what?
When you put a cell in one of these really salty solutions, the water leaves the cell and the cell shrivels up. The reason is actually the same reason that water enters your cell for hypotonic solutions. Water follows salt. Water follows salt, and what is our goal?
Equilibrium.
So if you have vomiting and diarrhea, or if you're really, really sweaty and you've lost a lot of fluids, those kinds of situations can put you into a hypertonic setup. So in hypertonic setups, you'll notice that our cells are in a really salty environment. Our cells will shrink or shrivel, and they'll continue to lose fluid to the surrounding interstitial space or even into the bloodstream. So hypertonic solutions mean that you've lost a lot of fluid and that your cells are shriveling or shrinking. The fancy word for it is to crenate. Not cremate, not with an M, but crenation with an N means that those fluids are leaking out of those cells, going to the area of higher salt concentration. You know, if you have trouble keeping straight who and what here, let me just remind you there's some built-in clues. O and hypo, O and bloat kind of stick you together. Hypo, hippo, hippos are big, right? Okay, those are some things to kind of keep you straight. Hypotonic fluids will make the cells big like a hippo. They'll bloat those cells. There's an ER down here for hypertonic. There's an ER. Oops, there's an E and R there. So crenate and shrivel have some E's and R's just like hypertonic fluids do. So they'll pull fluids out of your cells. Just a couple of helpful hints if you get yourself, you know, reversed on test day. What I've got for you here are two eggs. This is eggmosis. All you have to do is take the egg yolk, separate it away from the egg white. And one of these is in a hypertonic solution. One of these is a hypotonic solution. And I set this up about 7:30 or so this morning, so it's been in here about 3 hours. Do
Do you see there's a difference in the two egg yolks? They were identical. One's really bloated.
Yeah.
So which one is in the hypotonic solution?
Yeah.
This one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. And you know that because it's really bloated, right? Suck it in water. This one's in sugar water, and you'll notice it's pretty bright yellow compared to this one. So what's happening to the water in the egg yolk? It's leaving. Yeah, so I have been lazy in the past and left these sitting on my desk for sometimes several days. And after several days, it really becomes clear. This one becomes almost like a hard-boiled yolk. It's really, really dark yellow with all the water leaving. And guess what happens to this after several days? It blows. It explodes, yeah. So I'll come in and I'll find this exploded egg yolk, and people are like, oh God, clean that up because it stinks, right? But it's cool to see it get to that point where you've got, you know, the cell taking in so much water. So the reason I use sugar and not salt is if you've ever mixed salt and water, you notice how cloudy it gets. It gives it away. But if you put sugar water in there, the sugar makes the water clear, and it doesn't give you a hint in knowing which one was your hypertonic solution. So this is actually how red blood cells look in isotonic solution here. You know, they're pretty plump, pretty bloated. And then when they get into a hypotonic solution, they've become even more plumped out. And unfortunately, yeah, they can rupture if they happen to be in a hypotonic solution for too long. Why are they shriveling in this hypertonic solution? They're losing water. Is the solution too concentrated or not concentrated enough? Too concentrated, yeah, it's too salty. So if this was you, what could you do to fix the problem?
Drink some water.
Yep. And you'll drink until you are
full.
Hydrated. And your thirst mechanism says, we're good, cut it off, right? So you'll stop drinking when you feel like you're properly hydrated.
So hypertonic loses water.
That's right. Hypertonic solutions make cells lose water. On page 38, I left you another set of problems. I walked you through these with descriptions there. And on page 39, I've left you another set of problems with answers at the bottom of your page. So if you feel like you need a little practice getting your gears moving here, try those. And there's also some extra problems on page 40. How about questions on osmosis? We got the whole thing. You feel good about osmosis? Okay, good. So just something fun. Back in the day, you know, before refrigeration, way before our time, right, people used to salt their meat and hang it up to dry and then have like beef jerky over the wintertime. And the reason they salted the meat is because what?
It dries the water.
Dries it out, pulls the water out, yeah.
That's
so.
That's why we, people used to drop their phones in water, they put it in rice.
Yes.
So that's like the same situation.
I'll have to use that example next time because everybody knows about putting your phone in rice. Pull the water out. Yep. All right. So last page here on membrane transport is page 41. Okay. So we did diffusion. We said it was sometimes called simple diffusion. We just finished osmosis. This is the last of our passive membrane transport mechanisms. It's called facilitated diffusion. What does facilitate mean?
Help.
Yep. This is a type of diffusion that needs a little help. Thinking back, in order to be a diffusible substance, you had to be small or you had to be made of fat. Okay, so if you're not small and you're not a fat, then you may need some help, and that's where facilitated diffusion comes along. And what we do with facilitated diffusion is we use a protein channel like you see here, because these are probably molecules that are too big
to fit through your typical plasma membrane structure. Okay, so would you consider these to be integral proteins or peripheral proteins? They're integral, yeah. And so this integral protein here, kind of in a purple color, this protein actually is like a channel. It's like a big doorway, and big molecules have to go through this big doorway. If you were to allow these molecules to fit through our phospholipid bilayer, what might happen to your bilayer? Tear it up, rupture it, rip a big hole in it. So we say, hey, big stuff, you've got to go through these protein channels because otherwise you might rip a hole and kill our cell. So it's like moving. You know, if you've got to move really large items, you have to go through a really wide doorway. And that's what facilitated diffusion is. The same rules still apply. That means no ATP is required. That means we go from what to what concentration? High to low. Yeah, so it's just like diffusion, simple diffusion, with one big difference. We have to use a protein channel because our molecules are too big. Okay, so there's a question there for us to answer on the top of page 41. How does diffusion differ from facilitated diffusion? What would you say? Good, there you are, got both of them. You've got to have a protein channel for facilitated diffusion. Use a protein channel for facilitated diffusion. And second there, we have big molecules to move with facilitated diffusion. We have big molecules to move with facilitated diffusion. Okay, so two differences. Got to use a protein channel for facilitated diffusion, and the reason is we're using those big channels to move larger molecules. This always reminds me of an elephant foot stomping in a mud puddle, but this is in fact an axon terminal of a nerve cell coming down that's binding or, you know, releasing neurotransmitters that bind to a neighboring cell. So this is something we'll talk about in this course in a later chapter. Right here, these are protein channels, and they're showing us these molecules moving into the cell. They in fact move from high to low concentration once those channels were open. That's another cool feature, is these channels may be closed and they may be triggered to be opened. So you can kind of regulate what comes into the cell by keeping the channels closed and opening them on demand. So there's another way that we can keep our membrane semi or selectively permeable. All right, so let's switch gears and talk about active transport for just a moment. What does the word active imply that we must use? Got to use energy. Good. With these three types, we're going to work against our concentration gradient. We're going to go from low concentration to high. This is not really an equilibrium method. We're not going to reach equilibrium doing this. So let's talk about solute pumping. Imagine that all of your ions were on the wrong side of the membrane and you want them to go onto another side of the membrane. So this is what happens with sodium and potassium. We actually use an integral protein to pump those molecules across the membrane to their correct side. So in doing so, this little red dot here, this is a phosphate molecule, that's part of an ATP. And we have to pay off that pump in order to get the pump to open and move those molecules into their proper locations. Keep in mind, are we going from high to low concentration or low to high? Low. Yeah, we're going from low to high concentration. So that's why you have to pay this pump, because you're going against the natural flow of things. So as long as you've got ATP, those pumps will operate and you can move those molecules against their concentration gradient. You know, when people die, we always hear about their bodies getting stiff with rigor mortis and you can't move their bodies. Mm-hmm. The reason for that stiffness is because of the sodium potassium pump. If you don't have any more ATP to operate that pump just sits there, and the molecules naturally drift from high to low concentration. So this pump is constantly running to make sure that the molecules sit on the correct side of the membrane. So this is something we'll explore a little more when we talk about muscles. You know, it's imperative that we have this pump running to maintain our resting state. Okay, so the other two types of active transport are called endocytosis and exocytosis. Let's talk about those prefixes. Endo is moving where? Within. And what about exo? Moving it out. So if you need big bags of items moved into your cell, we use endocytosis. Large molecules are packaged and moved out by exocytosis. So in these two scenarios, we're going to use vesicles and vacuoles. Thinking back to organelles, what type of organelle makes vesicles and vacuoles? Which one? What organelle makes vesicles and vacuoles? Packages, modifies, and secretes. Golgi, that's it. So Golgi makes these vesicles, packages up these items, and either exports them out of the cell through exocytosis, or of course the cell can import those vesicles and vacuoles. That's a good point for me to remind you all to make sure that you read those organelles. They are on pages 31 and 32. And I just want to repeat one more time in case you didn't hear. I moved the test from this Thursday until next Tuesday because of the hurricane. I don't know what's going on. Even if we do have class Thursday, we will not have the test Thursday. We'll put it on Tuesday of next week. So this is actually how your body gets rid of bacteria. Your body will take in bacteria, kind of like what you see here. It packages them up in these nice little sacs called vesicles and vacuoles, and then it transports them over to some lysosomes and destroys the bacteria. And then, like all of us, it poops it out. So the bad stuff, the broken down bacteria, is actually removed from your cell by exocytosis. So, in fact, here come the bacteria in by endocytosis. There is that sac called a vesicle or a vacuole. And then your cell destroys the bacteria, and then there comes the discarded parts leaving through exocytosis. So this is a cool picture. This is anthrax being eaten by a white blood cell, simply taken in by endocytosis, and that white blood cell is determined to eat that bacterium. You can see how it's deformed the white blood cell's membrane there. But, you know, that's something we do on a daily basis is we pull in things through these sac-like structures and then we excrete them back out through exocytosis. These are considered active transport because what is required for this process?
Energy.
Yeah, got to use energy for this. Okay, so we have a few minutes left. That actually should finish us up. Page 42 is a practice page, and that is the page through which you'll want to study for the test. Page 43 is starting test 2 information. Okay, so study through page 42. Yes, yeah, study up 1 to 42 for the test. 43 starts the next test. Do y'all have any questions for the upcoming test? All right, I will see y'all maybe Thursday, if not next Tuesday.